the jungle that publishing was in the beginning when I started has transformed. It was a friendlier jungle then, but there are all kinds of people who are hanging around now and interested in making, you know, making sure that their efforts don't go unrewarded, meaning there's a payment up front.
Welcome to Literary Gumbo 2.0, the reboot of a video program I co-produced between 2010 and 2017. Each episode explores the world of writing, publishing, and book marketing. I'm your host, Lisa Engel, the right angle to help you write and sell your story. Sit back and enjoy. This is the last episode of the first season of Literary Gumbo 2.0. I'm looking forward to season two, but this first season I've dedicated to the memory of the original host of the Literary Gumbo talk show, Fred Klein, who had a very long and illustrious career in traditional New York publishing, which looks so completely different than today. And so I wanted to explore how publishing has changed over the last 50 years. And to do that, I came up with the perfect guest for today, everybody's favorite writing guru, Shelley Lowenkoff. Welcome, Shelley.
Wow, thank you very much, Lisa. And of course, you start right off by mentioning one of my oldest friends and connections in the publishing industry, the late lamented Fred Klein. And when I first met him, this is an interesting story. I was at the time the editor for a publisher out of Los Angeles, and we were a general trade publisher trying to make our way, and basically we were relying on sales of, you know, leasing the paperback rights to publishers like Bantam and Dell and New American Library. And so I had a couple of close associates in Bantam, and there I was with a project under my arm, and I was thinking, well, maybe I can pick up a commitment from Bantam. And I hear this sound coming from down the hall, and it's a sort of a bellowing, and the person whose office I'm in says, oh, don't worry about that. That's just Fred Klein. He always talks like that. And before I left the meeting, I had to go down and introduce myself and say, Fred, you probably don't know me, but, and you know the rest of it, because how many times in your memory did you pin the microphone on my lapel when I was on Fred's Literary Gumbo show? But that was the beginning. But to get directly to your subject, also at that time, let me start with this little bit of background. I got into publishing by complete accident. All I ever wanted in life was to be a writer, and that was my goal, my ambition. And I saw nothing more lofty, and basically that led me into the other side of the table, as it were. Before I got this particular job, which launched me on my publishing career, which was way back in the early 1970s. Can you does time go back that far? And I had a friend from the Thursday night writers poker game. He was born in Chicago with the name of Gunnar Hjørsted, and he changed his name wisely enough to Day Keen, DayKeene. And he sort of dropped this little bomb on me and said, if you really want to make it as a writer, you've got to develop your chops. And the easiest way to do that is to write a novel a month. Well, oh, okay, no problem. And I did. And then I said, so, okay, a couple of months, three, 4 months, I've got three, four novels. He said, well, now the trick, of course, is to sell them. And that was the next step. And in the process, I found a publisher of magazines and journals in Los Angeles who got into the so-called paperback revolution. And he hired me. He said, I have a list of books here. And how long do you think it would take you to write, or how many of these do you think you can write? And I, of course, scanned the list and pretended to read them. I said, oh, no problem. I can write all of them, because there it was again, an opportunity to pay the rent every month. So I was writing a novel and a work of nonfiction every month. And at the time, it was indeed possible to make a living, if not a respectable living, at least enough to pay the rent. So, in the course of that, the publisher then, who I was writing the nonfiction books for, followed me into his office and said, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, but the time is right and I need more product. You must have some friends who are writers. And I said, sure. Thus, that was my first step into, in a sense, becoming an editor. Calling friends in and saying, hey, I've got a gig here for you if you can handle this. And after a time, the publisher said, let's get serious, because you know New York, and that's where his background was, and he even hired a friend who was a sales manager at Grove Press, which was one of the icons, one of the early hardcover publishers of material that was not mainstream, but certainly sells today on eBay for big bucks. And so in comes a guy by the name of Hi Slepikov, who says, listen, you guys are doing this all wrong. We got to get things going here. And first and foremost, he says, surely you've got to have an office. You can't just keep coming in here and hanging around. So we'll get you a typewriter and put you over here. Oh, and by the way, I'm putting you in for a subscription to Publishers Weekly. You're going to find out what's going on in the industry. And after about 2 months, he said, okay, now I'm getting you a subscription to Library Journal, because as you will quickly see, that's where most of our sales will come from, libraries. And at the time, this was a big deal. If a hardcover book was taken on by, say, the Brooklyn Library or the Manhattan Library, that alone would pay for the production of the book. And so it was almost a guarantee of some kind of breaking even or profit. Well, that's how it was at the time. But also, because of Day Keen, Gunnar Hjørsted, who introduced me to his agent, Donald McCampbell, who at the time was known as the king of the paperbacks. And so McCampbell took me on as a client, and he said, "It is no longer, you're no longer going to have a problem selling these books you write every month. But while we're at it, and this is how publishing was also at the time, McCampbell said, by the way, I've been working on a memoir. Any chance you would be interested?" So here it is, and probably I am the first editor, because I didn't consider myself really an editor then. I just fulfilled a function, and I was certainly trying to develop my chops and get more experience and reach. But sure, I acquired Donald McCampbell's memoir, and indeed you can still find it on eBay, and I think I even saw it not all that long ago on Amazon, and the title of it is "Don't Step on It, It Might Be a Writer."
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
great
well,
point.
and he certainly McCampbell certainly had that attitude, and he, well, I kept getting writing assignments for him, but after a while, it began to seem like I could make a living as an editor. And so I cut back on my writing output and spent a lot of time reading books, talking to people I knew and trusted. And by the way, I'm going to drop another name for you, somebody who might be a good person to appear. I have a pretty tight friend here in Santa Barbara by the name of Mac Talley, Talley. Well, okay, Mac's father worked for New American Library, a man that I kind of wanted to be. I sort of saw as a role model. His name was Edward Ned, or his nickname, Ned Chase, and that's one of my connections with Mac. I knew and admired Ned Chase, and his father was an editor for Ned Chase, who was the editorial director of New American Library, and it. So the subtext here is contact. Being in the publishing industry, one got to meet and one got to know other editors, because when in the process of my first job as an editor, one of the paperback editors I saw in New York was her name was Agnes Birnbaum. Well, she was the editorial director of a small paperback publisher, and I sold, sold. I leased some of the rights to the titles I had published here in Los Angeles. And after a while, as things sometimes happen, Agnes got tired of her job with this small publishing company. I became a literary agent. And one of the first things that happened is she said, "I know you're not happy with McCampbell. He keeps throwing these awful assignments at you. I think I can do better." And so, in a sense, yeah, she poached me away from McCampbell. But the point is that it was more or less like a fraternity. And indeed, as I said in the beginning, all I wanted to do was be a writer and make my living that way, however well that went. And part of the deal was that at the time I had been hired away from my job with the LA publisher to run the Los Angeles office of an organization that was then called Dial Del Delacorte Press. And my rival, and this goes back in a way to my association with Fred Klein and some of the great people at Bantam, my rival was a guy by the name of Charlie Block, who ran the Bantam office in Los Angeles. One day, Charlie Block calls me and said for coffee, and we're talking. He said, "Listen, you got to do me a favor. We're having our sales meeting, and I'm going to be out of town for a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And I would really be grateful to you if you would take my courses at USC and teach them in my absence." So what I have done here in just conversationally, and what kind of mountain goat leaps of logic, Lisa, is show the accidental or distractions from my real purpose of writing, and first becoming an editor and getting to know other men and women who are in the publishing industry, and then as a teacher. Because after taking Charlie's classes, there was a graduate program at USC called the Professional Writing Program, which and the USC and all most universities make the distinction between a program and a department. In a program, the faculty does not have to have a PhD, does not have to worry about tenure track or any of that sort of thing. And so, okay, the head of the department at the professional writing program called me in after Charlie came back from his sales management sales meeting and wanted to get back to his teaching again. The chairman, himself a successful screenwriter, called me into his office and said, "Listen, the students are threatening an armed revolt if you don't come back. So promise me that I can rely on you to teach a course next semester." "Sure, what the heck? It's income, why not?" The thing that rankled me then, and even to this very day, in a sense, rankles me, is that I was a graduate of the university across the city from USC, and we were in a kind of bitter rivals. It's sort of like the rivalry between, say, Duke and the University of North Carolina. And it always rankled me that I had never been invited to teach at UCLA, but rather at USC, where it became a kind of institution that lasted for 35 years. And indeed, in more recent times, like around, 2010, 2012, around there, I was teaching in another interesting program at UCSB. And every time I drove on the campus, which I have to admit is a pretty attractive college campus. I've been on college campuses before, and that's with the possible exception of the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. They're all beautiful, and that's just sort of, well, that's Las Vegas. But every time I drive onto the campus at UCSB. The first thing that comes to my mind is, this isn't UCLA. It kind of rankles. But to get back to the subject then publishing and teaching were distractions from my goal of wanting to do nothing but writing. And the way I'm going to want to tie that up is to suggest this, Lisa, that it is my belief now things have happened in publishing and have progressed in not necessarily for the good, but not necessarily for evil either, but publishing has changed, and it is no longer that easy for an individual to make a living as such in publishing. And that also includes editorial salaries. Some publishers pay fairly well, but not outrageously. There are better ways, and if income only is an issue, like say plumbing or carpentry or even being a pizza chef. But that being said, there are more and more small publishers. The big thing at the time I fell into the industry and began making friends had to do with the seasonal list and the catalog. And every publisher was working. This is why in a lot of cases you send a manuscript to a publisher and you don't hear anything for a month, 2 months, 3 months, because the editor and the sales manager and everybody else is busy putting together the catalog for the coming year. And the larger publishers would have, 30, 40 books a season. And the smaller ones would have, say, 8 or 10 a season, meaning, more than 10 books, 20 books a year. And then the smaller publishers would publish maybe 5 or 6 books a year. But now there has been a proliferation of smaller publishers. And here we go with another situation. At the time I got into publishing, there was a term that was the publishing industry equivalent of the N word in common conversation, and that would be vanity publishing.
Yes.
That's what it was, what it was called. Oh, she's published by a vanity publisher, meaning, and now through euphemism, it's self-publishing. And indeed, I have known people who have done quite well with self-publishing, and there is nothing but good in both the product they produce and the service it provides. But largely, and this is in a way, there's an interesting equivalence now as the introduction of artificial intelligence into our life and culture is made. Self-publishing is a factor, and it's not going to go away. And in fact, it wasn't all that long ago when I even had an occasion to call the very same Mac Talley I mentioned to you earlier, and I said, "Do you have an accurate definition for this term hybrid publishing? I have an idea what it means, but I want to hear what you think, because I think it means self-publishing." And he more or less agreed with me. And I said, in effect, well, how do you square the fact that you, as a workshop leader and a participant in the Santa Barbara Writers Conference, include that as a part of the menu you offer people. And and Tally's answer, I think, is it just goes right straight to the point. He said, well, because it's a reality and people need to have a choice. So what I'm about to say now is my opinion. It's the way I see it, and I'm simply here being responsive to your goal here of getting me to talk about some of the changes in publishing. And what it involves is this: it's a shifting of the risk factor. The hybrid publisher has shifted the risk, the financial risk, to the writer. Most self-publishing publishers or hybrid publishers don't lose money because their income, yeah, is affected by sales, but it is not adversely affected by sales, which is to say that in most cases, the writer bears the cost, the risk. And back in the day, one of the things, in one of my early jobs as a publisher at an editorial meeting, there's a particular project I'm really plumping for. I want to publish it. I think that this book has merit and that there's an audience for it and that it's going to do all right. And I also have in mind some of the shall we say, the benchmarks. PPB is an important benchmark: paper, printing, and binding. How much is that going to cost? And
Yes.
you're aware of that one. And then there's another one, which is the author's royalty, because at the time I was first involved with publishing, the standard royalty went like this. For a hardcover book, the first 5,000 copies of the book actually sold, the author gets 10% of the cover price. All right. And then if it sells an additional 5,000 copies, that goes up to 12.5%. And then if it sells the 10,000 first and all subsequent copies that are sold, the author gets 15% of the sales price. Fair enough. That's equitable. Some might see that as not, but that works out pretty well, particularly when you consider that even today, and even in the case of self-publishing and whatnot, let's say that you and I have a book. Well, of course, in fact, we do, but we take our book to a place like Chaucer's and say, okay, will you stock my book? And the discount schedule there is 40% off the cover price. So a book that would sell for $10, I'm using that just because I'm awful at math in my head and I can mess with that. But a book that would sell for $10 is Chaucer's would pay $4. And so the publisher then would get, in theory, that remaining $6 from which they had to pay the author and amortize the cost of paper, printing, and binding, plus this wonderful weasel word called overhead. See, at the time, I was involved, my first experience in publishing, which was based in Los Angeles, it became really important and financially feasible for us to have a warehouse to store our unsold books or books that were about to be delivered in Nevada. So Sparks, Nevada. Why Sparks or why Nevada? Because California has an inventory tax. You didn't know that. Well, yeah, you have to pay X percent on every year on inventory, whether it's books or sausage or anything else. And also, in California, things in storage in California had an unpleasant habit of being invaded by things like mice, which is what Fred Klein had a great term for books that mice had gotten to. He said, "Oh, those are hurts, books that have been hurt by the mouse bites because they couldn't be sold." Well, okay, those are all factors that cut into the publisher's ability to gain anything back. And I remember giving this example of a particular book I wanted to publish. The publisher stopped me and he said, and again, this is historically sensitive. Interest rates in banks and whatnot were somewhat different than they are now. But what he said to me was, okay, looking at about $40,000 or $50,000 that it would take give the author an advance and pay for things like typesetting and promotion and all of that. If you're saying that if I took $40,000 or $50,000 and put it in the bank and bought a certificate of deposit for 6 months, that the sale and the ultimate sale of this book would bring me a greater profit, which is one of the things that editors have to learn. And if they don't learn it, they need to get another job someplace. And often the other job they get is a literary agent. But this is what I meant when I say that the heritage publishers, the standard publishers, bore the financial risk. And thus the whole concept of arrangement, financial arrangement between author and publisher. Most contracts, for most of the publishers I work for, in fact, with that very algebra in mind, have a contract that says that if there are subsidiary rights sold, the publisher gets a piece of the action. The company I work for and most hardcover publishers ask for and often got 50% of the income if a title was sold, was reprinted as a mass market paperback or even what we call a trade paperback. And then another important allied and subsidiary right had to do with motion picture sales, and we would get a small percentage of that. And remember also, Lisa, that most American contracts with traditional publishers say, in as many words, the author assigns English language rights or North American rights in the following project, meaning that there is a possibility for added income in French, Spanish, Italian, German, and Japanese, Chinese. So this term allied and subsidiary rights. That is also part of the algebra that an editor has to be aware of in the traditional sense. Now, another interesting thing too, because publishers are always busy doing what they do. It's how much time do they spend with acquisition, and how much effort do they put into it? And just as briefly as I can tell it right now, because I know we're on an hour class, here's an example of how this works. There still is a publisher who had a very reliable writer. His books sold fantastically well. Some of them were made into movies. There was no trouble selling his book. His name was, and he was a really good writer, Larry McMurtry.
Oh, yeah.
To show you how the information and intelligence section of publishing works, the word is out. And somebody at McMurtry's publisher gets the news. McMurtry has gotten on a plane in Dallas and he's flying to New York with his new novel. And unfortunately, it's 1,000 pages, which means it's going to be expensive. And then somebody else adds to it and says, "Oh, we had a brief chat with him, and unfortunately, it's going to be a Western." Well, okay, this information was in hand before McMurtry even got to New York, before the plane landed, and the decision had already been made. We owe him. We've made money from him. He's a great addition to our list. He's got a great future as a writer. So here's what we will do. We will give him a medium-sized advance, which is to say an interest-free loan on potential sales. And we will commit to publishing 3,500 copies of the book. And we'll write it off as a loss, because a book that size and a Western in today's market can't possibly sell. But there, of course, is the clause in his contract that says we get first look at his next book, and his past books have done well. And this is, and all right, this is giving him a chance. He wants to write a Western. Let him write a Western. Okay. They had no idea what they were getting into because, of course, the book, and you probably guessed this, Lisa, was Lonesome Dove, which is still selling copies, which shows in many ways how much publishers really know when you come down to it. So in an attempt to tidy up this business, I'll say this, that one of the reasons self-publishing is so popular is because a lot of people who want to write, who are concerned about the quality of writing, and who may in fact even think that what they have, their project has some literary merit or worth or lasting value, are too impatient and too frustrated by not getting answers or by being put on hold. I had a student, in fact, maybe you even know her because I think she's come to the writers' conference a couple of times, and she's from Ventura. It took her something like 4 or 5 years to get a novel she was working on in the condition where a publisher wanted to publish it. And even then, after the publisher said, "Yes, we will publish it," and then there was the process of editing and copy editing and all of that, It was 18 months after the agreement was signed before she hefted an advance copy of the book in her hand. And some people are really too impatient and too frustrated. And of course, they send a query letter to an agent, and sometimes they don't hear for a month or 6 months, or sometimes they never hear. And so it's like that play Orange, or that TV series Orange is the New Black. No comment or no answer is the new no. So naturally, they go to the so-called hybrid or self-publisher venue, where indeed they are told, "Oh, we can handle this. Oh, yeah, we love your book." But in so many ways, these hybrid or self-publishing venues do not have connections for distribution. And so it becomes up to the author, literally driving around with a station wagon filled with copies of the book, going from bookstore to bookstore. You start here, and then you go to LA, and then you drive to San Francisco, or maybe Denver, and of course there's Portland and Powell's Books, and then there's Seattle. And it puts more of the work that the traditional publisher does and the responsibility onto the author, and I would say 80 to 90% of the risk.
Yes. So I've been ticking off a lot of what you were saying as far as all the different changes that we see now. And it's like starting with that when you first started, they said, "Oh, okay, we got to get you an office. We got to get you in here and get you," which is something that we see today. We read about how publishers, whether they're in New York or no matter how big they are, they've got these people who hardly ever, maybe they'll come into the office once a week and they'll gather in a, but most people work from home these days in business.
And indeed, to take that one step further, Lisa, some of these people in hybrid or self-publishing consider this a side hustle. This is not their entire source of income.
Yes, there's got to be a lot of different things. And then there's what you've talked about, paper. You talked a lot about things that come back to paper and how much paper you must have dealt with over the years, as far as even probably just starting with typing something with paper, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the sounds I still hear in my ear and think about fondly, and it just reflects the change in technology. When I first started, it was on a series of typewriters, in some cases standard typewriters or portable typewriters. And at one at the appropriate time in my life, my father was working for an auctioneer, and often auctioning off businesses that went bankrupt or in some kind of failure, and there were always typewriters around, so I never really had to buy a typewriter. And then indeed a dear chum in the university gave me a wonderful typewriter. It was a red Olivetti portable. But what I'm getting at is the sound is, and you evoke that when you just said that word paper, Lisa. the sound, the gears ratcheting when you pull a sheet of paper out of the platen of a typewriter, and then you wad it up, and then you toss it to a nearby waste paper basket. And here's something else that has changed in the publishing industry, because I remember vividly, I had it was a gift from my cherished big sister. It was an oversized waste paper basket, and it had a pattern on it. It came with a pattern on it, but very quickly that became covered with rejection slips. I pasted the rejection slips using rubber cement on the waste paper basket, and it was covered. It was just, that was part of the bit. You typed a manuscript, you put it in an envelope, you went to the post office and got it weighed and sent it off, and of course you had return postage so they could send the manuscript back. And more often than not, it came back with a something, oh, the size of a small snapshot saying, we regret to inform you that your publication or your material was not found acceptable, or words to that effect. And now that's pretty much gone. I remember in teaching, I used to take a huge manila envelope filled with rejection slips and dump them on the desk and say, anybody know what these are? And they'd kind of look at it and say, what is that? And I'd say, well, your grade depends on it, because unless I can see that you've gotten five or six of these, you're not going to get anything higher than a C. Meaning, I want you to be sending stuff out. Well, now the rejection slips are emails, and almost invariably, here again, talking about assigning the risk to the publisher. Now, we'd love to see more of your work, and we'll be happy but allow us to suggest you subscribe to our magazine. And in future, let us know if you're a subscriber. We'll read your manuscript sooner. Okay, so I'm being somewhat, but not entirely, facetious about it, because individuals come along, and in our way, Lisa, I have to point my finger at both of us, you and me, because this is one of our they're one of our hustles too. We consider ourselves editors, and yes, I agree entirely, and you know from past experience that I'm well aware of your editing experience, and I know you are appreciate mine. But a lot of people call themselves editors, and what they mean is that they got an A in grammar.
Oh. Yes, they say that if you want to find a good editor, make sure you don't get an English teacher.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's the worst kind, because one of the great things we both learned is that you don't need complete sentences, and in fact, sometimes complete sentences are way too formal. Indeed, a former student of mine just had an experience with a literary agent you and I both know, and the literary agent is saying, what are you sending me people who are so informal for, using complete sentences and all of that? Well, yes. So it is in a way, the jungle that publishing was in the beginning when I started has transformed. It was a friendlier jungle then, but there are all kinds of people who are hanging around now and interested in making sure that their efforts don't go unrewarded, meaning there's a payment up front. And my question, it's a kind of the rhetorical question, how is a writer supposed to deal with this when a writer is probably managing to, just barely managing to be able to rent and internet bills to keep the computer going in order to be able to send letters and manuscripts to various publishers and literary agents. Writing most books, most in trade publishing, by which I mean books, hardcover, paperback, trade paperback, are sold in bookstores, in newsstands, and of course sometimes through mail order, through Amazon and Abe Books and other platforms. But trade publishing is distinguished by the fact that in a given year, and certainly in this particular century, we're getting close to having knocked off a quarter of this century already. But as far as this century is concerned, the average novel sells 500 copies or less. And that goes back, that includes, by the way, the so-called heritage or brick and mortar publishers, the Simon and Schuster publishers and whatnot. And there are all kinds of interesting deals. And just to show you how this works, here in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, this was back toward the end of last year. I think it would have been around October of last year. I had a deal, an arrangement with our local bookstore, Chaucer's, because I had a book forthcoming from the Berkeley imprint out of the Random and Penguin family, and I was, I was even given, oh, well, we'll have an evening and a book signing, and you can talk about your book and read the first chapter. And then a box arrives, and this usually happens from publishers with authors' copies of the book. And I see printed across the cover, it says, "For sale only at Walmart."
Oh no.
Oh, yes. And that's part of the deals that publishers are making now. So Mike at Chaucer says, "I can't let you in this store with a cover that says available only at Walmart."
Oh.
So much for that, and there it is. But by the same token, I sent a quick note to the editor to complain, and she said, "Well, do you have any idea what Walmart's first order of your book was?" "No." She said, "Well, would you believe their first order for the whole, this is for the whole chain, but they ordered 25,000 copies of your book." And I said, "Well, that's certainly going to pay for the paper printing and binding, won't it?" And she said, "Oh boy, will it ever? And if it does well, they'll order another 25,000." So they're taking in a way some kind of a gamble by excluding other possibilities, other sales platforms. But that's another one of the changes that have happened in traditional publishing. And the difference is the traditional publisher is aware of that and basing a lot of their go or don't go decisions on it, which is why, in a sense, you have to look to writers such as, oh, say, I'm thinking Jane Smiley, because I'm always so fond of her work, or Louise Erdrich, who, if she doesn't get a Nobel Prize pretty soon, there's no justice in the world. We know their books are of outstanding and literary quality, and they can pretty well do whatever they want. So that's not even a question or an issue. But
So
go ahead.
so you've got the book that's available at Walmart, but
Yeah.
you also you've also have dealt with small publishers with
Yes.
the Fiction Writer's Handbook.
Oh
You,
yeah, that was different altogether.
yeah.
That was different altogether because the place where that book was launched is one of my favorite bookstores of all time, and that's Vroman's in Pasadena. In fact, I remember vividly as a kid, like 12 or 13, and my father taking me in there and saying, "This is what a bookstore should be like." And I'm looking around and looking for titles that I recognize, and I'm saying, "Someday I'm going to have a book in here." Well, it was true, but small publishers have to work harder, and truth to tell, Romans, in this particular case, their first order of that book was 10 copies. And so in effect, and the publisher knew all about this, so we went to that with a carton of the book in our car just in case. But here again, here is a carton of books. I think there were something like 50 in there. And in order to filter it, to sell it in Romans, even though they didn't buy it or order it in the first place, we had to give them a 40% discount because they've got to survive too. But there it goes right back down to the question of risk. And in a way, Mark Twain, one of my favorite writers of all time, wrote a book that in so many ways informs my attitude, my literary voice, my approach to writing and to life. It's called The Innocents Abroad. The writer today, unless she knows exactly what's going on in the world of publishing, is an innocent abroad and is likely to be taken in by, there's one particular editor, I call him, and he comes out of New York, and I know he's hit at least 10 or 12 people here in Santa Barbara. He hits them for a $10,000 editing fee. And there's no promise that the book is going to get published. He said, "I'll do my best to call it to the attention of people I know." And again, to go back to that theme of the, at one time at least, the closeness of writing community. One of the people I met very early in my writing career was the publisher of a small New York publisher. It was called Stein and Day, Saul Stein and Patricia Day, husband and wife. And from that point on, Saul has been a close friend and associate. And one of his books, Stein on Writing, is the Bible for people who want to be fiction writers. And indeed, my copy of Stein on Writing, which was a gift from Saul himself, is for Shelley, the editor who edits editors, because yes, he used to pay me to read his the manuscripts of his novels. And Lisa, you mentioned that one of my nonfiction books, called The Fiction Writer's Handbook, there's a blurb on the front cover from a dear friend, Rennie Brown, who at one time was the senior editor, the lead fiction editor for W.W. Norton, one of the early and continued forces in literary fiction in America today. So it was a tight-knit group. And just to give you another interesting lick on Fred Klein, whom you mentioned with such fondness when you began in the literary gumbo. Not that many years ago, of course, Fred was still living both in life and in Santa Barbara, but Fred and I and Mark Jaffe, the former editor-in-chief of Bantam Books, were having breakfast, and Mark Jaffe is saying, you know, given our particular interest in mystery fiction or whatnot, we ought to start a small publishing company, just the three of us, and Shelley, you and I would be the editors, and I'd do all of the paperwork, the publishing stuff, and Fred could be the sales manager. And of course, my contribution, yeah, we call it OF Books for old fart. Well, but again, there is a kind of a closeness of people in the industry. It's still there, but it is more dispersed because more individuals are, for whatever their reasons, going to graduate programs in colleges, incurring, by the way, incredible student debts to learn their way into writing, and absorbing some of the things that Lisa, I know you read every book on writing that's coming out, and you've got a great memory, and you can cite even the page where Moss says a particular thing, and I really admire that. But they also are using that as a way to get jobs in the publishing industry. One of my better students at USC became a senior editor at St. Martin's Press and remained in that position for several years until she couldn't take it anymore and is now a literary agent. It just there most people who have been through the publishing process in the traditional way are, I would say, more stable and have a greater overall integrity and awareness of the publishing process. And those who don't or who haven't have the option of doing one of the things you do so well, Lisa, which is tracking the new books about writing and publishing and digesting it and putting the work to use. Most, and again, there's a literary agent you and I both know, and one of her favorite jokes to an author is, well, there, I've got good news for you and bad news. And of course, the writer is saying, what's the good news? You're getting published. All right. And what's the bad news? You're getting published. And sometimes you don't realize until you've been through the process. Lisa, I know you certainly know the difference, but how many wannabe writers, how many people who have paid $5,000 or $10,000 to a self-publisher know the difference between development and content editing and copy editing?
That's true.
Not many,
Yeah.
and I know, Lisa, I know you know because you even heard me telling the story at one point where a copy editor dinged me in a historical novel. I mentioned somebody who was selling Fuller brushes, a Fuller brush salesman, and the copy editor sends a note and says, Fuller brush was not in operation at this time. So you're either going to have to change that reference or change the time frame of your story for accuracy. And of course, my answer to that is I said, no, He was this was when Fuller was selling the brushes out of his parents' garage. And she bought it. She did, but which told me immediately, well, that one other thing told me something about her that she was quite a bit younger than me. Because Lisa, you probably remember a radio program, two great Canadian comics, Bob and Ray. Does that ring a bell?
A little bit of one.
Well, okay, they had a couple of fictional characters that they used in some of their skits, and one of them was named Wally Ballou. He was the equivalent of Chet Huntley, and I'm sorry, of Tom Brokaw. And then there was Chet Sturdley, who was meant to be the equivalent of Chet Huntley. Well, I threw a character in this book, and I named him Chet Sturdley, and she didn't question it. She let it go, and so it's just little things. We play little games, but the change is growing toward smaller and more independent venues. But I have this to say, and this goes all the way down the line. One of the oldest publisher in America is still publishing, the first publisher. The first publisher in America. You'll never guess what its major title is. It's the Four Dummies books, which shows how it goes from biography, autobiography, and history to the Four Dummies series. Okay, well, that's one of the changes, but there are a lot of small publishing ventures, and they last maybe a year, 5 years, 10 years. There is still a Grove Press. Back in the day when I knew it was avant-garde, in political and somewhat sexual, and I knew Barney Rossett, the publisher, very well. There was a really wonderful publisher here in Santa Barbara when I first came. It was called Black Sparrow Press. He moved, he sold his home, in fact, in Santa Barbara, and moved north because he made enough money on it so that he was able to buy a piece of property in Northern California that had not only a home, but a storage building to store books, and then eventually sold Black Sparrow Press to another larger publisher. So that's still in the market. But bookstores, restaurants, and publishers, the three business ventures or hustles that have the greatest risk and go out of business more often than not. And yeah, things are changing. I predict that there will be a lot more small publishers, and a lot of these small publishers are going to do very well and be very responsible. Who would have thought? We think about publishing. We still think New York or Chicago, and certainly some of the university presses, because they sell an awful lot of books. Like so, New Haven, which is for Yale University Press, and Berkeley, of all places, which is where the University of California Press head office is located. But mostly when we think about publishing, we think, say, New York. For a while, we thought about San Francisco, and certainly we think about Boston. We think about East. So who would have thought? And Lisa, you probably already know the answer, but you can look it up very easily. Who would have thought Minneapolis would have two real small independent publishers, they both do like 10 or 12 books a year, which is to say the equivalent of one new book a month. But they're beautiful, they're well printed, they're well edited, they are well reviewed, they are well written. And so is it, is all of this stuff about hybrid and self-publishing damaging only to those who don't take the trouble to learn the trade and the craft properly?
That's true, because I've been contacted with people by people who say, "Can you help me promote my book? It's up on Amazon." And I go and do the look inside and read the first couple of pages and say, "Well, first of all, you need to hire an editor." And so they, if they know how to use a computer and Microsoft Word, they can just go take their manuscript and put it up on Amazon without any help from anybody else. And that doesn't mean that maybe it's a good story, but it needs work. It needs help. And people won't buy it unless it's got that polish to it.
So true, so true.
Nobody can, no matter how good a book marketer is, you can't sell something that has not been, that doesn't have a good cover, that doesn't have a good description, first.
Particularly the cover, that really, yes. And that was another thing too. When I first started in publishing, it was not just a tradition, it was an imperative. You wanted to be an editor, you had to work, at least for the first 5 years on the job, you had to work 2 weeks a year in a bookstore simply to get the sense of how people behaved in bookstores, what people were looking for. And you're mentioning, Lisa, the cover is so important, and there are some artists who have made their name because of the book covers that they design. I'm thinking particularly of Knopf's noted and legendary book designer Chip Kidd, but I have a great friend in Toronto whose designs are always winning awards in Canada, and one of my personal favorites, because she's done a number of my books, is Deb Daly, who lives now in Venice, but for the longest time she was the design chief at St. Martin's Press. They have an idea of the philosophy and psychology of graphic arts. And you need all of this. It's a dangerous and it's a scary game, but it's a playable game and a winnable game.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and very educational. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you for inviting me.